So I want to start off by thanking the organizers for inviting me to be here today. I want to tell you about spintronics in sort of the small scale limit, where we're talking about just manipulating one or two electron spins on a semiconducting chip. And I'm going to show you today that we can use these gallium arsenide double quantum dot devices to prepare, say, a well-defined spin singlet state on a chip, to coherently manipulate the spin state using the exchange interaction, and then to measure some resulting spin state using a spin selective transition in this type of device. I want to acknowledge my coworkers. I've been very fortunate to have two really strong graduate students help me out during this project, Alex Johnson on the experimental side and Jacob Taylor on the theoretical side. We have a very nice collaboration with Amir Jacoby and Misha Lukin, and our materials are grown here at Santa Barbara by the Gosser Group. And I'd like to thank Micah Hansen and Art Gosser for helping us out here. So we've seen really tremendous progress in the past 10 or 15 years of the kind of systems that we can create in the laboratory. Today I'm going to tell you about a particular system that's called a double quantum dot. And one nice feature of this double quantum dot is that we can use it to control interactions between two electron spins on fast timescales. So you can really think about creating an artificial system in the laboratory that has some simple tunable Hamiltonian. And the nice property of this Hamiltonian is that it has some matrix element that depends on gate voltage. So we can really think about going into the laboratory, tuning some knob on our apparatus, and controlling the interactions between electron spins. And if we can do this fast enough, we can really think about driving quantum dynamics of the system. So we can start to think about applying the ideas from the AMO type fields to our solid state systems. And I'm going to show you today that even though these systems are relatively simple, they contain just one or two electrons, we can still study some very nice sort of fundamental physics with these devices. We can try to understand what sets the spin relaxation times and the spin dephasing times in these simple systems. And at the same time, we can think about using these devices to make quantum bits to either store, say, a spin state for some amount of time, or to try to coherently manipulate some spin state. So Daniel Oss gave a very nice introduction on using gallium arsenide quantum dots to isolate and manipulate single spins. So I'll go through this kind of quickly, but if we want to think about pushing this idea of using semiconducting structures for spin manipulation, there are two relevant timescales, or what I like to call figures of merit, that become important if you want to try to characterize the quality of the system. The first is the spin relaxation time. So imagine we can create some non-equilibrium spin state in a laboratory. The decay of the spin state to the ground state is going to be governed by the spin relaxation time, or sort of a T1 process. And what's remarkable about these systems is that several groups have shown that these T1 times can be quite long. They can approach millisecond or even 10 millisecond timescales. And while this might seem like a short time scale at first, we can really think about manipulating things in the laboratory on nanosecond or even, say, hundreds of picosecond time scales. So there's something like six orders of magnitude difference between our manipulation time and the spin relaxation time. And this is good news for us if we really want to try to manipulate single electron spins. So now that we know that these T1 times are long, what we need to address is, you know, what sets the spin dephasing time. And at least from the theoretical side, there are two important contributions that can set this dephasing time. The first is the spin-orbit interaction, and Daniel showed that this is weak in these types of systems. So if we just take into account spin-orbit, we should expect long T2 times. What I'm going to show you today is that even though we have this relatively simple spin system with a single electron and a gallium arsenide quantum dot, it really sits in a complex spin environment. And in particular, our single electron spins in these quantum dots are coupled to about a million gallium arsenide nuclei through this contact hyperfine interaction. So you can think about this electron spin sitting in our confinement potential. It has some wave function, and this wave function overlaps with about a million nuclei. And as a result, this electron sees an effective magnetic field. And for our device parameters, this field scale is on the order of a few millitesla. So why is this hyperfine field important in terms of spin dephasing? If you imagine taking two electron spins that are initially in phase on a chip and spatially separating them, any variations in the local hyperfine environment are going to result in different effective magnetic fields that these separate electron spins see. So on some characteristic time scale that's set by this hyperfine field scale, or fluctuations in this hyperfine field, these electron spins are going to dephase. And if you just take this 3 millitesla field scale, this implies about a 10 nanosecond T2 star time, or dephasing time. So today I want to tell you about measurements of spin relaxation times in double quantum dots, spin dephasing times, and I'm going to show you some tricks that we developed that allow us to actually coherently manipulate spin states and use some tricks from NMR to just extend our dephasing times out to microsecond long time scales. So the outline of my talk is follows. I first want to tell you briefly how we make our devices, and then I want to talk a little bit about pulse gate techniques and show you how we can use, say, fast pulses to change our confinement potential in this double quantum dot and actually drive single electron charges around on this chip on microsecond or even faster timescales. You can think about taking a single charge and moving it in this double quantum dot with a high degree of precision. The first piece of physics that we can look at then is a measurement of the spin relaxation time. So we're going to measure the decay time of some spin triplet state in our double quantum dot. And I'm going to tell you about an experiment in which we measure the spin dephasing time, or the T2 star time, of the spin singlet state. So we're going to take a spin singlet state in our device, we're going to spatially separate the electron spins, and then we're going to look at correlations between the electron spins at some later time. And I'll tell you the answer right now. What we find is that these electron spins lose their memory on about a 10 or 20 nanosecond time scale. And one of the reasons that we wanted to look to the spin degree of freedom is that we expected that these dephasing times would be much longer. So at first glance, this is bad news if we want to use electron spins for quantum computation. But luckily, there's a way to get out of this. And we've worked hard to develop some control techniques based on the exchange interaction that allow us to drive coherent oscillations in this two-electron system. So I'm going to show you how we can drive rotations between singlet and triplet states on our chip. And then we're going to extend this to implement what I call a singlet-triplet spin-echo refocusing pulse sequence. So we're going to try to get rid of the bad effects of the nuclei, implement an NMR pulse sequence, and I'm going to show you that this allows us to have coherence times that extend out to microsecond or even tens of microsecond long time scales. So our devices are fabricated in aluminum gallium arsenide heterostructures. We have a two-dimensional electron gas. It's about 100 nanometers below the surface of our wafer, and what we want to do is dice up this two-dimensional electron gas to create two little individual puddles of electron gas. So we have two quantum dots, and we want to make these very small so that we can just isolate one or two electrons. So to do this, we create this Tigold gate depletion pattern here. This is our double quantum dot. If we put negative voltages on these gates, we can deplete the two-dimensional electron gas that lies beneath these gates. And if we appropriately bias these gates, we can create a simple double well potential. This is sort of the simplest way to think about this device. Now, we can tilt this double well potential back and forth just by changing the gate voltages, or we could change the overall depth of one of these wells by changing the gate voltages, and in that way change the electron number. Another feature of this device is that it's flanked by quantum point contacts. So on the right-hand side of the device and over here on the left-hand side of the device, we have two quantum point contacts, and we're going to use these quantum point contacts as charge sensors to actually determine where a single electron sits inside of this device. So these types of devices have historically been measured by looking at conductance through the double quantum dot as a function of these gate voltages. So if you map out conductance through the double dot as a function of the right gate voltage and the left gate voltage, you change electron number and you sweep through the standard Coulomb blockade peaks in conductance. So in the end, you recover this characteristic honeycomb charge stability diagram for a double quantum dot. One of the limitations of this old style conductance measurement is that it doesn't tell us what the absolute number of electrons in our double quantum dot is. And we really want to know if we're dealing with 100 or 2 or just 1 electrons. So to determine the absolute number of electrons, we're going to take advantage of this quantum point contact charge sensor that sits next to the device. And sort of give you an idea of how this quantum point contact works, I want to compare two measurements, one of sort of a standard Coulomb blockade peak measurement by measuring the dot conductance, and another measurement here that shows you the charge sensor conductance. So in red, this is a plot of the double dot conductance as a function of gate voltage. As we make this gate voltage more negative, we're pushing electrons out of the system, and each time we push an electron out of the system, we pass through a Coulomb blockade peak. If we take a closer look at this charge sensor conductance, we can see that there's a large overall slope just due to direct capacitive coupling between the gate and the quantum point contact. But in addition, each time we cross one of these Coulomb blockade peaks and push an electron out of the device, you can see that this charge sensor conductance increases by a small amount. So the presence of an electron in the double quantum dot effectively gates this quantum point contact. So if we pull an electron out of the device, this conductance increases by a small amount. And basically, we can determine when an electron moves from, say, one side of the dot to the other or exits the double quantum dot. So now what we can do is, say, differentiate this black curve here, and these small features will then come out in a much clearer form, and we can use this type of measurement to determine what the charge stability diagram is. So what you might imagine is if we made these gate voltages negative enough, we would just completely deplete the two-dimensional electron gas. There would be no more electrons to push out of the system, and our double dot would be completely empty. So if we take a look at this diagram, this is a charge stability diagram. In the lower left corner of this picture, both of these gate voltages are very negative. And you can see that there are no more lines in this picture, so there are no more charge transitions. And we know that down here in the lower left corner, our double dot is completely empty. So no more electrons to push out of the double quantum dot, and we see no more charge transitions. Now what we can do is just slowly increase one of these gate voltages. If we make this right gate voltage more positive, we move over in this direction in this charge stability diagram, we can pull a single electron into the right quantum dot. We call that a 0-1 charge state. Or we could do the same thing and just slowly increase the left gate voltage and pull a single electron in the left dot. We call that a 1-0 charge state. So now we have a very simple way to control this device. We can measure this charge stability diagram, and then if you tell me I want one electron on the left dot, one electron on the right dot, we can just park our gate voltages in this region of the charge stability diagram, and we know what the occupancy of the system is. Now, there's been a large amount of work trying to study charge coherence in gallium arsenide quantum dots. Some really beautiful experiments by the Japanese groups Fujisawa and Hayashi measured charge coherence times in mini electron quantum dots and found that the dephasing and relaxation times are really quite short. They occur on nanosecond or even faster time scales. And we did some experiments with the one electron quantum dot and basically reproduced these types of results and found very short coherence time. And the reason here is that the charge degree of freedom basically couples to everything. If there are any two-level systems inside the device, these fluctuating two-level systems couple to the charge, and we basically have a very fast relaxation and dephasing time for the charge degree of freedom. So for the remainder of the talk, I want to talk about trying to manipulate spin physics in these types of devices, and I'm going to show you how we can make a simple two-level system based on two-electron spin states. So we're going to focus on this two-electron regime where there are two electrons in the double quantum dot. So why is this two-electron regime interesting? It turns out that even though it's slightly more complicated than a one-electron system, it gives us a very nice handle in the laboratory that we can use to, say, tune exchange interaction between two electron spins. So let's examine two cases. We're going to focus mainly on two different charge configurations. The first is a 1-1 charge state, where there's one electron in the left dot and one electron in the right dot, and the other is a 0-2 charge state, where we put both of these electrons into the right quantum dot. Now on this 1-1 charge state, we can set the tunnel coupling between the left dot and the right dot to be relatively small. Then the splitting between the singlet and triplet states is practically zero, even at dilution refrigerator temperatures. So you can think of these singlet and triplet states as being practically degenerate. Now if we compare that to the 0-2 charge state, we have both electrons in a single quantum dot. Due to the tight confinement, we're basically creating something like an artificial helium atom. So there's a very large singlet-triplet splitting in the 0-2 charge state. And we find and measure experimentally splittings between these states on the order of about 5 Kelvin. So there's a very large energy splitting here. And we can take advantage of this to, say, initialize into a spin singlet state, a 2-electron spin singlet state, or to read out some remaining spin state after we do some manipulation. So I'm going to show you how we can take advantage of this difference in singlet-triplet splittings to actually manipulate this type of device. So we can get some idea of what's going on by looking at DC transport measurements. So in single quantum dots, there's something called excited state spectroscopy that you can use to determine the energy level spectrum inside of a quantum dot. And here's some data of a copper nanoparticle that I took in graduate school where you can see excited states as a function of magnetic field and all sorts of avoided crossings. Another way to take this type of data is to sweep a source drain bias and gate voltage, and you'll see these standard Coulomb blockade peak diamonds in this conduction measurement to basically determine what the excited state spectrum of the device looks like. In a double quantum dot, taking this kind of data is just slightly more complicated because instead of having a single quantum dot, we now have two quantum dots in series. And if you wanted to determine what the excited states of the double quantum dot are, you basically have to take measurements in a two-dimensional parameter space. So you're measuring, say, current through the double quantum dot as a function of a right gate voltage and left gate voltage. And instead of measuring these Coulomb blockade diamonds, you measure something that looks like triangles. So we call these excited state bias triangles in a double quantum dot. Now something interesting comes about if you take a look at charge transport in this device. In the one electron regime where there's either one electron on the right dot or one electron on the right dot, these finite bias triangles are symmetric. So if we reverse the sign of voltage, these finite bias triangle is basically flip direction and the sign of the current changes, but the overall magnitude is the same. So nothing really interesting is happening in the one electron regime. Now what we can do is move to the two electron regime. And what we find is if we measure these finite bias triangles in the two electron regime, at positive bias, we see a large current. At negative bias, the current is suppressed. So this is something that's called polyexclusion. And the idea is if we try to push electrons through the quantum dot in one direction, say from a 0-2 spin singlet state to a 1-1 spin singlet state, this transition is allowed, so we measure current at positive bias. If we reverse the sign of bias, we can end up in a situation where we try to push a spin triplet state into a spin singlet state. And this is not allowed due to polyexclusion. So there's a rectification in current transport that occurs due to polyexclusion. And one way to think about this is we're creating something like a singlet triplet spin valve. We can pass singlet states through the device, but if we create a spin triplet state, we can't push it into a spin singlet state, and then current through this double quantum dot is blocked. And this was first measured by Ono and Tarucha back in 2002. So now what we'd like to do is use, say, the singlet triplet spin valve to actually read out some spin state in our double quantum dot. So we're going to move away from DC transport measurements, and I'm going to show you how we can use some new pulse gate techniques to really try to drive single charges around in our device. And some of these ideas were first proposed by Levy here back in 2002. So I'll talk about the coherent manipulation later on in the talk. So let's take a step back and think about how this device works. Again, this is our double quantum dot. You can think of it as a simple double well potential. And to determine what's going on with this device, we measure this charge sensor conductance as a function of these gate voltages. So this is a plot of the charge sensor conductance in the two electron regime as a function of the right gate voltage and the left gate voltage. And what you can see here is this characteristic charge stability diagram for a double quantum dot. For each charge state, there's a well-defined charge sensor conductance. So in this type of picture, if you tell me what the charge sensor conductance is, I can tell you what the occupancy of the double quantum dot is, or where each electron on the device is. Now what we want to do is extend this, take this one step further, and try to convert, say, spin information into some type of charge signal that we can then measure using this quantum point contact. So to really drive transitions in a double quantum dot, we've had to learn how to send high-speed signals down our dilution refrigerator to the sample that sits at about 30 millikelvin in the bore of a superconducting magnet. So we have a standard dilution refrigerator. It's equipped with several high-frequency lines, and we can send down, say, gigahertz or tens of gigahertz signals down to our sample and really put very fast gate voltage pulses on our device to tilt this double well potential on fast timescales. So we can try to manipulate a single electron charge just by changing this double well potential by applying small pulses to these gates. And it took us a while to learn how to do this. We had sort of been going along measuring sort of old-style charge transport measurements. So that it turns out there's a pretty easy way to determine what pulses do to the double quantum dot, and I just want to run you through this because we're going to, I guess, take this for granted later on in the talk. This is a charge stability diagram that's measured without pulses on. If we want to determine what a pulse does to the system, we can apply just a simple two-level pulse to the right gate, so we have some high pulse signal and some low pulse signal, and that gives us basically a double copy of this charge stability diagram. One copy shifted with respect to the other copy by some amount that depends on the voltage that we apply to the system. And then we can do the same calibration for the left gate, apply a pulse to the left gate, measure the charge stability diagram. So now we have our sort of two unit vectors. We have, if we apply a pulse to the right gate, it shifts us by some amount in this parameter space. If we apply a pulse to the left gate, it shifts us by some other amount in parameter space. And so by just simply adding up pulses applied to the right gate and left gate, we can move in any direction in this charge stability diagram. So now what I want to do is show you how we can use these pulse gate techniques to drive a single electron through the double quantum dot. I showed you earlier transport measurements where we saw this rectification due to polyexclusion. What we're going to do now is instead of, say, applying a battery across the device, we're just going to modulate the double well potential by using these pulses and try to, say, juggle electron all the way through the double quantum dot just by modulating this double well potential. So in this charge stability diagram, what we do is we start in the 0-1 region of the charge stability diagram where we have a single electron in the right quantum dot. We then apply a pulse to the system and move up into the 1-1 region of the charge stability diagram. Here the singlet and triplet spin states are practically degenerate, so we can create either a spin singlet state or one of the three spin triplet states. And since there are more triplet states, let's imagine that we create a spin triplet state. Now what we want to do is measure the lifetime of this spin triplet state, or this decay time, And to do that, we apply another pulse to the system, which just simply tilts our double up potential. So we have a 1-1 charge state, one electron on the left dot, one electron on the right dot. We're now going to apply a pulse to the system. We tilt the double up potential so that both electrons want to be in the right quantum dot. And when we do this, we set the energetics such that only the 2-electron ground state spin singlet is energetically accessible. And what this means is if we create a 1-1 spin triplet state, when we tilt the double up potential, we're basically trying to push this triplet state into a spin singlet state. And this transition is blocked due to Pauli exclusion. So we'll have the double up potential tilted. The electron really wants to roll over into the right dot because it's the ground state. But it'll remain stuck in a 1-1 charge state due to Pauli exclusion. So by measuring this charge sensing signal, we can tell whether or not the electron tunneled over to the right dot or not when we do this tilt. And that's how we can determine whether or not we have a spin triplet state or a spin singlet state. And now what we can do is repeat this pulse sequence many times. And in this charge stability diagram, that corresponds to, say, pulsing around one of these triple points in the charge stability diagram. And this is how you make a charge pump. So we can repeat this pulse sequence many times, continuously try to pump a charge through the double quantum dot. And if we take this charge stability diagram with the pulse sequence on, we find that instead of just measuring 4 distinct charge sensing signals corresponding to each charge state, we find this triangular region here that we call the pulse triangle. And the signal inside of this pulse triangle has some value that's intermediate between the 0-2 charge sensing signal and the 1-1 charge sensing signal. And again, the way to think about this is we're trying to pump single charges through the double quantum dot. If we create a spin triplet state up here and try to push it into a spin singlet state, the triplet's not going to tunnel to the singlet state. So we're going to remain in a 1-1 charge state even though the double up potential is tilted so that both electrons want to be in the right dot. So in here, we measure some charge sensing signal that has a value that takes on something close to the 1-1 charge sensing signal. So the presence of this signal means that we have a spin triplet state. And now if we want to measure the lifetime or the T1 time of the spin triplet state, we can just wait and watch for how long it takes the signal to fade out and just extract a T1 time from that type of measurement. So these data here show you plots of this charge stability diagram for several different parameters. Let's take a look at the top first. We're going to fix the magnetic field at 100 millitesla and just change the time that we wait in this tilted configuration. And you can imagine if we waited in this bias configuration long enough, sooner or later the spin triplet state is going to decay to the singlet state, and then it's going to tunnel over to the right dot. So in the long time limit, this signal should completely fade out. And what we find is as we increase the time from 8 microseconds up to 80 microseconds, this signal just decays. We can extract a decay time from that. What's maybe more surprising is that if we set the time to 8 microseconds and change the field from 100 millitesla down to 0 millitesla, we find that the field, that this signal almost completely vanishes near the inner dot charge transition. So what this data means is that near zero field, the spin relaxation is strongly enhanced. It's much faster right around zero magnetic field. And you can see if we sit at zero field and wait for a long time, this signal is completely gone. So it's almost like we have no pulses applied to the system at all. So what's driving this spin relaxation? We think the answer is that these hyperfine fields are driving the transitions between the singlet and triplet states. In this 1-1 charge configuration, the electron spins are separated, so each electron spin experiences a different hyperfine field. That results in an effective gradient between the left dot and the right dot. And in the singlet triplet basis, these field gradients are very efficient at driving rotations between the singlet and triplet states. So why is there a magnetic field dependence? If we accept the external magnetic field to zero, then these electrons just see this fluctuating hyperfine field. So there's some field gradient between the left dot and the right dot that depends on the local nuclear spin configuration. And as these hyperfine fields evolve, we're just going to map out a large range of parameter space. Now, if we crank up a large external magnetic field, say a 1 Tesla magnetic field, we now have a well-defined 1 Tesla magnetic field and a small 2 millitesla fluctuating hyperfine field component sitting on top of that. So the range of parameter space that we map out is really much smaller. So one way to think about this is there's some hyperfine field on the order of a couple of millitesla. If the Zeeman splitting exceeds this characteristic hyperfine field scale, then spin relaxation times are much longer. So we can summarize our experimental data in this type of plot. This is a plot of the decay time of our spin triplet state. As a function of detuning, this is just the tilt of our double up potential and magnetic field. And I'll just point out a couple of features. If you look here at zero magnetic field, the red data, we find that the spin state decays on about a microsecond long time scale. if we just simply crank up the field to about 100 millitesla, 150 millitesla, our T1 time extends up to millisecond or even tens of millisecond long time scales. And we can fit all these experimental data with a simple model that just takes into account this hyperfine interaction. When we do that, we can extract this nuclear field scale, and we find that's on the order of 2 or 3 millitesla. So this implies about a 10 nanosecond dephasing time. So now I think we understand quite well what's driving spin relaxation, at least in the low field limit. Let's move on now and try to understand what sets the spin dephasing time in the double quantum dot. So now I want to tell you about our experiment. I call this the double dot electron interferometer. And you can think about this as a way to really measure correlations between electron spins using something that looks very much like an interferometer. So we're going to start off by placing 2 electrons in the right quantum dot. We know that these form a ground state spin singlet. And now what we want to do is separate the electron spins. So we tilt our double well potential. We separate the electron spins. And now they experience different hyperfine fields. So that's going to drive some rotation between the singlet and triplet states. What we want to do is determine how much rotation occurs when the electron spins are separated. So we're going to wait for some amount of time, and then we're going to try to put the electrons back together. And we're going to find that this electron can only go back home if the electron spins remain in the spin singlet state while they're separated. Because if I rotate into a triplet state, we can't tunnel back to the spin singlet state due to this Pauli exclusion. So really, you can think of this as an electron interferometer. We're taking a spin singlet state on our device. We're separating the electron spins. They evolve for some amount of time. And then we're trying to put them back together at a later time to measure correlations between the electron spins. And to make this work in practice, we use these pulse gate techniques again. So we start off in the 0-2 region of the charge stability diagram. We now separate the electron spins by applying a pulse to the system. These separated electron spins experience different hyperfine fields, so they process at different rates. In a singlet triplet picture, this just corresponds to the hyperfine fields driving some rotations between the singlet and triplet states. If we want to determine how much mixing has occurred, we now do our spin projection measurement. We tilt our double well potential and try to put both electrons back into the right quantum dot. Now, if we remain in a spin singlet state while the electron spins are separated, we'll just adiabatically follow across to the 0-2 spin singlet state. But if there's some hyperfine mixing when the electron spins are separated and we rotate into a triplet state, when we do this projection measurement, we're going to remain in a 1-1 charge state due to Pauli exclusion. So if we rotate into a triplet state, we're going to measure some 1-1 charge sensing signal. If we remain in a spin singlet state, we're going to measure this 0-2 charge sensing signal. And now we can repeat this experiment many times. So let's take a closer look at this energy level diagram. There's some tunnel coupling between the left dot and the right dot. So the 0-2 charge state is hybridized with a 1-1 charge state. So there's an avoided crossing in this energy level diagram. The spin triplet states can be split off by applying a Zeeman energy. And since the 0-2 spin triplet state is very high up in energy, it's somewhere way up here, there's another avoided crossing between the triplet states, but it's off the page in this type of picture. So the triplet states just cut right through. Now you can see in this plot of the energy as a function of detuning and magnetic field, you can see that there are several positions in this energy level diagram where these spin states are degenerate. The first one is here, where the Zeeman energy basically compensates for the hybridization of the charge states. You can see that if we decrease the magnetic field and make the Zeeman splitting smaller, this green resonance condition is going to move out to more negative detunings. So for this particular resonance condition between the singlet and the T plus state, we expect to measure a very strong magnetic field dependent signal. Out at more negative detunings, there's a large range of detuning over which the singlet and T0 states are nearly degenerate. So at these regions in this parameter space, the hyperfine fields are going to drive transitions between these two spin states. And finally, if we sit at zero magnetic field, all of these triplet states become degenerate. Now our spin singlet state can rotate into all 3 triplet states through these hyperfine fields. So we can actually map out this energy level diagram experimentally. What we do is we create a spin singlet state. We put 2 electrons into a single quantum dot. We then separate them at some value of detuning and magnetic field and hold them separated for a time scale that exceeds this hyperfine mixing time by, say, a factor of 10 or 20. So if there's a resonance, we're going to rotate into a triplet state if that triplet state's there. We then do a projection measurement to determine how much of the singlet state we have left after the separation time. So this is a plot of the singlet state probability as a function of the detuning. This is, again, just the tilt of our double well potential and magnetic field. And the first thing that pops out in these data is this very strong magnetic field dependent signal here that I've marked with this dashed green line, this corresponds to the singlet T plus resonance condition. So at points on this green line, the singlet and T plus states are nearly degenerate, and the hyperfine fields can drive transitions between the singlet and triplet states. At more native detunings, there's a broad but somewhat noisy signal that turns on. This corresponds to the singlet T0 resonance condition. And finally, right around zero magnetic field, our singlet state can mix into all three triplet states. So we measure an enhanced triplet state probability, or say a smaller singlet state probability, right around zero magnetic field. Now, if we want to measure the dephasing time, all we need to do is determine how long does it take for the signal to turn on. So what we can do is we can prepare our spin singlet state, we can separate it for some amount of time, and let the electron spins evolve, and then we can do our projection measurement. And what we find is if we plot the singlet state probability as a function of the separation time, after about 10 or 20 nanoseconds, we just end up with some mixture of singlet and triplet states. So the hyperfine fields have completely mixed these spin states in a 10 or 20 nanosecond time scale. And we can fit these experimental data with a simple model that just takes into account this hyperfine mixing mechanism. You'll notice that there's a zero magnetic field curve and a 100 millitesla magnetic field curve. In the zero field curve, the singlet state probability is smaller just because of this triplet state degeneracy right around zero field. So now I want to introduce you to this block sphere type picture. Let's imagine for the rest of the talk that we're sitting at finite magnetic fields, so that the T plus and T minus states are split up by the Zaman energy. Now we have a simple two-level system. The Hilbert space is spanned by the singlet and the T0 triplet states. So we can draw this in a block sphere type picture. I'm going to put the singlet state at the north pole, the T0 state at the south pole, and the up, down, and down, up states on the x-axis of this block sphere. In the singlet triplet type picture, the hyperfine fields, or the random hyperfine fields, basically result in an x-axis rotation in this block sphere type picture. So if we take a spin singlet state and separate the electron spins, this random hyperfine field is going to rotate us away from the north pole of this block sphere. And if we repeat this experiment many, many times, as the hyperfine fields evolve as a function of time, this rotation angle is going to be different from one experimental run to the other. And so in an ensemble type picture, if we start with the spin singlet state and keep the spins separated for some amount of time, this arrow is just going to fan out and take over a large range of angles. And when we do our projection measurement, we're going to measure a diminished singlet state probability. So now what we'd like to do is try to correct for these hyperfine fields. And the key to this is the ability to be able to turn on and off the exchange coupling between these electron spins on fast time scales. So I sort of glossed over this earlier, but there's actually a splitting between the singlet state and the T0 triplet state that depends on the double well potential tilt. And you can see at very negative detunings, these states are practically degenerate. But right up near this inner dot charge transition, there's a large exchange splitting that can be tuned by the tunnel coupling, and this can approach, say, gigahertz type energy scales. So we can turn on and off the exchange just by tilting our double well potential by applying a pulse to the system. And this gives us a very nice handle to actually control the system. So what does this exchange energy do? In this block sphere type picture, if we initialize into an up-down spin state and turn on this exchange energy, exchange drives a z-axis rotation in this block sphere picture. So a special case of this is a swap operation where we rotate this up-down spin state into a down-up spin state. And what I want to do is show you that we can actually use this fast control of the exchange energy to drive these coherent rotations. So the pulse sequence is described above. We start in a spin singlet state. We have two electrons in a single quantum dot. We then separate the electron spins slowly with respect to the hyperfine mixing time and turn the exchange coupling between these spins off. And that loads us into an up-down spin state on the x-axis of this block sphere. We can now drive a rotation about the z-axis by tilting our double well potential and turning the exchange energy on. This gives us some z-axis rotation. After this rotation, we can then adiabatically ramp back out and project back onto the singlet and T0 states of this block sphere. So this is a plot of the singlet state probability as a function of the time of our exchange pulse and the detuning. The tuning here just sets the exchange energy. And you can see these nice oscillations in the singlet state probability as a function of this pulse time. So these are coherent rotations in this block sphere type picture. We've worked hard to make these rotations as fast as possible so we can increase the tunnel coupling between the left dot and the right dot. That increases our exchange energy, and we can drive these rotations on, say, 300 picosecond type timescales. Now we can extend this a bit further and try to implement an NMR type pulse sequence that's called a spin echo. And the spin echo is basically going to allow us to error correct for these hyperfine fields, these random hyperfine fields. So the picture here is that we start with a spin singlet state. When we separate the electron spins, the hyperfine fields rotate our block vector away from the North Pole by some random amount. Now what we can do is turn on a pi pulse, which basically rotates this block vector about the z-axis of our block sphere by an angle pi. Now the random hyperfine fields that rotated us away from the North Pole are going to rotate us back up to the North Pole. So if these dephasing times and rephasing times are equal, we'll retain our spin singlet state. This is called the spin echo. And here are the experimental data. This is singlet state probability as a function of exchange time and detuning. And you can see very nice singlet state recoveries when we put on a pi pulse, a 3-pi pulse, or a 5-pi pulse in this exchange pulse sequence. What's remarkable about this pulse sequence is that we can keep our electron spins separated for half a microsecond, perform this pi pulse, hold them separated for another half of a microsecond, and then we retain our spin singlet state. So the spin echo type pulse sequence allows us to extend our coherence times up to microsecond long time scales. So where do we go from here? In the last few minutes, I just want to kind of motivate the discussion part of the session. We still don't know exactly what sets this microsecond long decoherence time. We have some initial experimental data that shows that if we increase the magnetic field, we can extend this up to, say, 10 microsecond long time scales. So one of the things that we'd like to do is try to understand in better detail which processes lead to the decay of this spin echo type signal. One of the problems with our qubit, you know, even though we have a very efficient way to, say, initialize into a spin singlet state and read out the system, is that we don't really have a universal set of gates right now. And the problem is, you know, I showed you that by turning on and off exchange, we can drive z-axis rotations. The problem with this qubit is that it's sensitive to field gradients, and these hyperfine fields change as a function of time. So each time you do the experiment, you have a different hyperfine field. It gives you a different x-axis rotation. And if we really want to try to use this two-electron system to make a quantum bit, we need to learn how to get around this problem. One way to do this is to try to program the nuclei, take advantage of this resonance between the singlet and T-plus states to actually polarize the nuclei. And in this type of way, you could create a field gradient by programming the nuclei that is fixed as a function of time. Another maybe more obvious way is to put a permanent magnet on the device. Next to these permanent magnets, you can have very large field gradients on the order of a Gauss per nanometer. And now you have some large field gradient and a much smaller fluctuating hyperfine field gradient. So there are pulse sequences that you can use to sort of error correct for these small fluctuations. Another way to get around this is just change the Zeeman splitting between, say, the left dot and the right dot by using G-factor engineering. And finally, the reason that our spin echo works is because these hyperfine fields change slowly as a function of time. So if you could measure the hyperfine fields on a fast enough time scale, you either do the state narrowing that Daniel talked to, or you could just correct for it. You could measure the hyperfine fields. You know what the hyperfine field is and what type of rotation it's going to give you. Looking sort of out, you know, more long-term type picture, a couple years out, one question we have is whether or not we can take a spin singlet state and shuttle it down our chip. We know that if we separate our two electron spins, we're really in trouble because after about 10 nanoseconds, these electron spins lose their memory. But this doesn't mean that it's impossible to take a spin singlet state and transfer it for a large distance down our device using these confined quantum dots. What we're working on now is we're trying to couple two of these singlet triplet systems together. So this is a coupled qubit experiment. One of the nice features about this two electron system is that the exchange energy depends on the tilt of the double up potential. So that means that we have a very natural way to couple these systems together. Any change in the charge state of this double quantum dot is going to capacitively couple to the other quantum dot and change its exchange energy. So by putting these two double quantum dots next to together, we think that we can make a more complicated type device. So with that, I'd like to conclude. I showed you that we can take these simple double quantum dots and manipulate a single charge on fast time scales using these pulse gate techniques. We measured the spin relaxation time and the spin dephasing time, or T2 star time, and determined that these are set by this hyperfine interaction. I then showed you that we can use fast control of the exchange to drive these coherent oscillations and implement a spin echo type pulse sequence that extends our dephasing time out to microsecond long time scales. What I think is nice about this two-electron system is that we've added on a layer of complexity by going from one electron to two electrons. But now we have a really nice handle in the laboratory, a way to really control the exchange interaction between these electron spins, and it just makes things technically much more simpler. So with that, I'd like to conclude. Thank you for your attention. I'll take questions.
Thank you. Questions? Michael.
Let me bounce back there quick. Yeah. This is it's really an ensemble type measurement, and you know, we can manipulate very quickly. What we haven't gotten so good at so far is measuring quickly. So you know, we can manipulate in microseconds or nanoseconds, but each data point is, you know, a tenth of a second. So we're averaging over 100,000 shots. This is really a measurement over many of these full sequences. What we'd like to do to sort of motivate future work is learn how to measure very quickly. Because if we could measure this type of curve before these hyperfine fields changes, then we'd expect to see some sort of oscillations in this type of picture. And that's how we could extract these hyperfine fields.
J is proportional to t square over u, and u is the function of the human f. You presume to measure the t, yes, in one electron, for the rounding off of the.
Yeah, so.
So
go ahead.
Are you actually, is J actually t square over u?
It's a bit more complicated than that. I mean, out here, when the double up potential is symmetric, then the exchange splitting that we measure is what you'd expect from t squared over u. But near this inner dot charge transition, there's actually some hybridization of the charge states. You're mixing in the 1-1 charge state with the 0-2 charge state. And in the 0-2 charge state, there's a huge single triplet splitting. So near this inner dot transition, it doesn't go like what you'd expect. I mean, it's hard to define what tunnel coupling means right near this charge transition because you're sort of changing the probability. So we have a person at Harvard, he's called Mike Stope, who is very good at calculating these things using density functional theory. And he can calculate, say, let's see, I had a plot here. He can simulate these types of curves of exchange as a function of detuning. And you know, with a reasonably large number of parameters, he can, you know, reproduce these types of data. But it's not as simple as the t squared over u over this entire parameter range. But we think we understand at least, you know, what's setting the overall shape of these types of curves. Yeah. Right. Yeah, I can show you some data afterwards. So the question is, what's setting this decay time? And you can imagine if the hyperfine fields are changing during this pulse sequence, then the hyperfine field during the dephasing part of the pulse sequence could be different than the rephasing part of the pulse sequence. And so the spin echo is not going to be as efficient as it would if these fields, you know, were fixed as a function of time. So one way to get around that is to do a more complicated pulse sequence called Karp-Purcell, where instead of just doing one shot of exchange, it's kind of a bang-bang pulse sequence where you're doing exchange periodically and sort of correcting for evolutions in the hyperfine fields. And we've done that. We still want to map out all the parameters. There are a lot of knobs to tune, but it at least doubles this time. Going from, say, this type of pulse sequence up to a Karp-Purcell extends this out to 2 microseconds. And if you put on a field, we end up with something like 10 microseconds at half a Tesla. So the limitation or the technical problem was that when these experiments were performed, the sample was in perpendicular field. And when you tune perpendicular field, the device basically changes every time you change the field. So it's very painful and time consuming to do these types of experiments. So our goal is to basically take this sample upstairs to where we have a vector magnet, and we can map out the full field dependence, say both perpendicular and parallel, and really try to determine what's setting this decay time.
But I guess they have to scale up that and it's more probably.
I think what are the numbers? 10 picoseconds is kind of the fastest that you can manipulate. So we still have some range, and the number that we quote is 300 picoseconds for a swap or 150 for a squared or swap, and we can actually go faster than that. The question is, what's in the lab that you can apply the pulses with? And we're limited more by the boxes that we can hook up to our setup right now, rather than the actual exchange splittings, because we can make those very large. And especially in, say, Chirrut's vertically coupled quantum dots, these can be 100 microEV or some very large timescales. Sure. As far as is pulse overshoot and things like that, basically what's important is that our pulses are reproducible from one run to the other, because it's the integral of this exchange. So if they're reproducible, we can basically calibrate for them. But if you talk about factors of 10 to the 4 and things like that, we're right now worrying about the first 9 or the first digit in sort of the accuracy of these pulse sequences. And I think as things progress and we get better at this microwave engineering type business, we'll be able to do a cleaner and cleaner job with these experiments. Well, it's a question of what's the power spectrum of this noise, and really how high is sort of the weight of the fast part of the pulse sequence. So if you take a pulse of a nanosecond and say take the FFT, usually things die off, say, a factor of 4 faster than a nanosecond type pulse. So it's a question of how fast these decay out and whether or not they're really going to kill us at adipaticity. We can also do pulse shaping. We're doing the simple thing here of just putting on a square pulse, but we can put filters in. And this is one of the things that we actually try to do in the lab, to basically slow down the approach to the top of a pulse. And so there are ways to get around this, these types of problems, just by using pulse shaping, I think.
Other questions? Well,
I guess we get to eat early.
Maybe we can, have a few minutes before lunch. Oh wait, we have one more question.
When you go through this transition in the double dot, when you had this diagram, 3 triplet states and 1 singlet.
Sure.
Yeah. So you are in a regime where a singlet is the ground state or the triplet is the ground state.
We start off with the spin singlet state, and basically what we have to do, this is a danger point. This singlet T plus resonance, that's a bad spot in this phase diagram. So,
but you go to the left, and then the T plus is the ground state, yes?
T plus is the ground state if you wait for a T1 time. But if we do everything much faster than a T1 time, so the assumption here, and this might be what's setting that actual echo decay, is that we have a two-state system here, singlet and T0, T plus and T minus are out of the picture, because you basically have to flip a spin. So there's a long time scale process between going between a singlet state and say the T plus state. So as long as this manipulation occurs over here much faster than say a relaxation time down to T plus, we're okay.
My point was that these relaxation processes are different whether you are on the right-hand side of this diagram or the left-hand side of the diagram. I wonder if there's any evidence. That's due to spin-orbit interaction.
Though the energy splittings are different. So there's some phonon density of states that, the single-triplet splitting over here is much larger than it is over here. The earlier measurement I showed of the relaxation time was done in the left-hand part of this diagram. So we know what T1 is, it's well characterized in this part of the system. Over here, we're preparing the system in the ground state, the eigenstate, the spin single state, when we do our state preparation. So the relaxation here is, the triplet state's half a millivolt up.
My point was that because it's different, different triplet states are connected to single states, and from these different triplet components, one can deduce the type of spin-orbit interaction that's there.
Okay. Yeah, right. I think this question that Sankar asked about what sets this 1 microsecond time scale is going to give us a little bit more evidence actually of what's happening out here at long time scales and what the decay mechanisms are into these states. But at least at low fields, a few millitesla within zero magnetic field, we think it's hyperfine. But as we increase the Zeeman splitting, other processes can become important too.
So it could be the factor of 5 that they saw in the experiments? Going to half a Tesla, well, in half a Tesla, the T2 time went up by a factor of 5.
So 1 over B or...
I wanted to ask one question. It's on the last slide. You had a diagram. Was one of the last slides? You had a diagram with a whole bunch of these devices lined up. Could you comment, maybe broadly, about the relative difficulty or how you expect it to become easier over time to make devices in which there are increasing numbers of gates? And
The fabrication is relatively straightforward. It's basically you make some ohmic contacts, you do electron beam lithography, you do one step of Tigold liftoff. So it's really fairly easy to make these types of devices. What worries me in the more long-term kind of time scale is if we have a chain of these things connected together, how do we do the actual electrical manipulation? Because there's not much on the market that we can commercially buy right now that allows us to put, say, 10 or 20 synchronized gigahertz or 5 gigahertz sources together. So the real headache, I think, in the future is going to be the microwave manipulation part of this business, and whether or not we can learn how to do this sort of fast enough.
So you're saying that the real limitation is the number of control fields that you need to be able to put down,
Rather
than the number of electrical gates themselves.
Yeah. This was no harder than making the other device. What we do is, it's really, I'd say, pretty, it's sort of the easiest thing you can do. Our fast pulse generator, it can put out a nanosecond or a quarter nanosecond signal, depending on which box we use, and there's just a bit of overshoot when you shoot up on the top of that. So to reduce that overshoot, just externally, right on the output of the pulse generator, we just put a low-pass filter that has 100 or 200 picosecond characteristic rise time, and we just try to smooth that transition from high to low out. And we haven't gotten into sort of the really fancy type of pulse farming yet, just because it's really hard. If you, there are a lot of different time scales in this experiment. There's the manipulation time scale that's nanosecond or sub-nanosecond. There are all these different ramp times, a readout time that's a microsecond. So you need a pretty versatile box that you can hook up to your system that allows you to do, fast manipulation and also relatively slow manipulation. And there's not much out there right now. The best thing that we can find are these arbitrary waveform generators. So if you want to do really complicated pulse shaping, I think we're going to have to get some type of pulse generator that really has a much faster sort of time base, so you can really think about going in there and adjusting our waveform features on, say, 100 picosecond or 50 picosecond time intervals. But this gets really expensive very quickly.
Okay, well, let's thank Jason again, and that concludes the morning session.